Hello, welcome back to Millennial 2018, and I'm now here with Oliver from the channel Semiogog. So welcome, Oliver.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the invitation.
So first, introduce people to yourself and your channel and the kinds of things that you talk about there, because it is it's an interesting channel, and you go for it.
Well, I'm not really sure how best to characterize it. excuse me, I'm having the beginnings of a bit of a cold, so bear with me. I think it's a mix. I would say that probably 70% of the content is sort of what I call the great game as a spectator sport. So I very often speak with an old friend of mine, Mr. Tim Rudisill, and we go back and forth, sort of chewing the fat as regards developments around the world, cultural, political, you know, strategic, cat and mouse kinds of things. So that's probably 70% of what's going on there. Then about 30% is my own sort of speculation as regards all sorts of cultural phenomena out there. And I believe that there's probably, it depends on, you know, what happens to be on my mind at any given point, but there's also discussion of what we call esoterica. So, you know, what would typically be called the occult or metaphysics, these sorts of things. So it's kind of a mix, but it's mostly the great game as a spectator sport, and then, you know, cultural critique, that kind of thing.
So when you say, what do you mean the great game? What is that?
The struggle for global dominance. The various parties on the game board of our planet Earth who are attempting to assert their will and influence the affairs of men.
And when you say as a spectator sport, that implies that you see yourself as a spectator in all of that.
Well, to the extent that I have no inside knowledge about any of the events, I don't work for a government, you know, that kind of thing. But insofar as I am a citizen of my country, I hope to enjoin, to encourage other people to think hard about what's going on and what their own role in all of that is, and how they would have the world be. So it's not essentially passive, you understand?
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. I was wondering, because there is always this question of how detached one should be. So when I said about you being a spectator, that wasn't an accusation. I'm just curious about how you deal with that dilemma. Because obviously there is a question, because you have to choose, how am I going to conceive of myself in this situation? Am I going to see myself as an active agent who, which might be a delusion, or as a spectator, which might be more truthful, or it might be, you know, impotence inducing?
Well, I would imagine it's probably somewhere, there's a continuum, you know, and it runs from progressive hipster irony, which is sort of total detachment. And then you can sort of, you know, look at the other end of it, where detachment manifests fruitfully as being just detached enough, just objective enough, if that's at all possible, you know, true objectivity, but objective enough to invoke reason. You know, there's a certain distance one must stand apart from things in order to not be caught up in it, you know, with the sort of pathological altruism and emotions.
Exactly. That's the other, the other part of this. So what is the other question I wanted to ask was, what does the name mean? Where does it come from, if anything?
It's probably what they call too clever by half. You know, one of the common things that people confront is when they're starting whatever it is that they're going to do online, they have to look around, you know, see what sort of names have not already been seized or don't already have someone camping up on them. You know, so you get names like Google, you know, these made up words. So in this case, I liked the idea of semiotics, semiology, you know, all of these coming from the Greek root sema, which gives us sign, you know, so the study of signs, significance, meaning, and it just sort of fit together, to my ears anyway, neatly with demagogue. So it's the idea of, you know, someone who speaks to the public about signs.
Right. Okay. Excellent. That does make a lot of sense. Now that
only when it's explained, and that's kind of like having to explain a joke. You know, you suddenly find that no one's laughing.
Well, it's because the word semiotics is not known by a lot of people, but also even I learned about semiotics at college, even I didn't think of that. So that's the problem. But yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, you've got that name.
The problem's so manifold.
But yeah, I've just always wondered about the name. So I think we should get to the topic, which is easily introduced, really. Because when I first, I first saw your channel, I think about a year and a half ago. I'm not sure, though. And then about a year ago, I saw a video of yours where you were sort of addressing the alt-right. And you were very skeptical about various things. It was the individual versus the collective. Because I know that you and Tim, is that his name? I've forgotten his name.
Yes.
Tim.
There are some who call me.
he is very into individualism. He's very much sees himself as, I mean, he said that only the someone who is truly an individual is actually truly human, which I wouldn't agree with, by the way, because I think a lot of people are natural followers, and you know, that's the creatures they are, and that's fine. But I think that would be a fairly strong disagreement between me and Tim. But, and I don't want to sort of make this about him, but it's just the only reason I mentioned that is that your concern at that point, when I first saw that video, your concern was very much about the fate of the individual in any society that operated on any kind of collectivist paradigm. And so you were very much skeptical about this. You seem to be keeping an open mind, but you were very skeptical about it indeed. Yes. And then more recently, maybe 3 months ago, maybe less than that even, I saw a video of yours where you, and I watched several throughout that interim, but then finally there was one a few months ago where you seem to have accepted that some sort of collectivism is necessary, or at least that's how it seemed. So I want now for you to sort of clarify and explain, if you can, this evolution, if there even has been an evolution. So you take it away.
Well, we'll see how I do with this, with the identitarian baton handoff. I think that there is a great deal of imprecision going on. Now, I've been accused on any number of occasions, quite justifiably, of sort of, you know, gazing at my navel too long and getting tangled up, you know, in my own drawers in terms of considering all the different things that might be brought to bear in whatever it is that's under consideration. But in this case, I think it's fair to say that precision in definition is really important. So where you might think it would be a need, or it might come across as though I believe that there's a need for collectivization, in fact, I don't. I believe that there is a need for cooperation. And, you know, as I've sort of waved the individualist banner, which is fundamentally, I think, a kind of elitism, at the same time, you know, I recognize that people need to cooperate, and there is nothing that I see inherently about being individualistic that prevents cooperation on whatever basis, whether that be based on shared ideals, whether it be based on shared culture and ethnicity or shared race. So cooperation, I think, is an important aspect of all of this that often gets lumped together with collectivization. Collectivization, I think of more, you know, along the lines of somebody like Gustave Le Bon in his excellent book, The Crowd. I imagine you're probably familiar with that, or, you know, Hitler saying that crowds are essentially feminine, if I'm attributing that to him correctly.
I think so, yes. The masses are like a woman I can bend to my will, was a quote that I remember seeing attributed to Hitler when I was in high school, and yet I've never been able to find it you know, more recently. But whatever, I think we both know what we're talking about.
Right, and I too went looking for it and couldn't find it, which is why I'm hesitant. But at any rate, you know what I'm talking about. So collectivization seems to be the kind of thing that entails the subsuming of the individual. And I don't want to get too far off into this, but, you know, the hypothesis that's thrown out there is that what lies beneath all of us is a collective unconscious. And I think that that's an aspect. So, you know, if you take a look at outside of Western culture, because I certainly am a devoted Western chauvinist, I'm a cultural supremacist, if you will. if you take
a look at Gavin McInnes.
Well, he's, I used to be a punk rocker and I'm almost his age. And I think he has his uses much and his important things that he does that I can't do, just like a Sargon of Akkad or a Gavin McInnes. But no, I don't rest at all there. But as I was starting to say, it's we think of a collective unconscious. And if you look at a ritual behavior, like if you take a look at Voudon, for example, right? You got the drums going, you've got people dancing around, you've got this intense ritual atmosphere, and the culmination is the disappearance of the individual and what they call the mounting of the individual by a rider, a divine horseman, one of the Loa, one of the spirits of the West African and Orisha systems. And it subsumes the individual. So like Gede, the Lord of the Dead, might appear. And for the Voudon people or Santeria or any of the rest of the variations of it, to test, to be sure that you're really dealing with the manifestation of the archetype, they'll do things like blow hot pepper and whiskey into their eyes, right? And things like this. And you have to, they have to see proof that the person is impervious to things that might otherwise hurt them. Or they look for other manifestations of, you know, the numinous. Well, that's what happens outside of Western culture. But in Western culture, we have heroes. We have the idea of individuality as a thing to which we aspire, even to the degree that we have things like, you know, Hercules or the rest, you know, these human figures that may have been descended from gods, but who ascend to the status of gods as demigods, this sort of thing. And it's that sort of thing can be found in many Indo-European traditions. So I bring all of this up because on the one hand, you have the idea of a subconscious, a collective unconscious, you know, the idea of going downwards to a shared foundation. But from the direction I come, and there inherently is a sort of mystical and religious aspect to it, there is a superconscious that exists within the individual. And it's the idea of, you know, macrocosm, microcosm, as above, so below. You know, generally people think about that in terms of the shared foundation and the collective unconscious. But for me, each of us carries within us a universe. And that universe, multiverse, whatever, holds all of it. Now, that's not to say that there isn't a shared foundation that we all have, what's typically called the collective unconscious, but the individual superconscious also contains everything that can and cannot be. And so when you say the kingdom of God is within you, it's like, you know, to take it, an example from a particular religious tradition, there's this idea that I carry all of my culture within me. It's, I have no need to have recourse to something that is shared with everyone, though that exists as well. And these things, you know, there's a certain point at which it becomes, you know, more intellectual noodling to try to split the Venn diagram in order to pull the circles away from where they overlap. But what I'm trying to get at here is that, and this is why I go to collectivization, you know, and cooperation as an alternative to it. In order to participate with what's mine and even with what's shared culturally, I don't have to retreat to the level at which there's a shared common denominator. I can ascend to the point at which all of it is contained. And that is individual. You can look at that in the sense that I carry the genetic heritage of all of those who've come before me, you know, and I'm particularly a good European, you know, as Nietzsche would have called it, in the sense that I've got all these things are mixed together in me. I run from the east to the west of Europe, you know, as you only find in America or these other colonial outposts where the whites faced with other groups that were so distinctly other formed this identity of white as a way to distinguish themselves. So I guess to come all the way back around, when we talk about identitarianism, individualism versus collectivism, I'm still working on it. And, you know, there, to some extent, you know, I looked at some of my past clips, like you talked about, where I'm just sort of going on against, going off against identitarian stuff and, you know, saying that the alt-right is a leftist trap and the rest. And I can see that I'm tangled up in a number of things, you know, all sorts of things that you can't kind of, you've got one leg in the trap and your choice is either to stay in the trap or just gnaw it the fuck off. And so I arrived at a point where I felt like I need to just rip loose of this. And so I see the value in what you would perhaps call identitarianism. And I think that it needs to be there as a counterbalance, particularly culturally, against all that's going on. I'll add to that that I agree entirely that there's a really serious problem, any number of really serious problems, and that what you can call Hawaiites, and in particular white males, are in the crosshairs, and they are being systematically subverted and destroyed. And I don't like the idea of simply being scraped off of someone else's shoe. And so I see that there is a need for cooperation. And, you know, as I talked about individualism, and I say cooperation versus collectivization and the unconsciousness inherent in collectivization, the renunciation of individual agency inherent in allowing oneself to be, you know, washed about by the tides of collective reaction. People on the alt-right or dissident right have said, well, you know, fine, you talk about cooperation, you know, clearly there's a problem, why don't you cooperate? And so I decided, okay, I'll be proof that individualism does not have to be the atomized and atomizing thing that everyone claims it is. And I can attempt to put my money where my mouth is. You know, when I've said things in the past about how a group of cooperating individuals is always already far more formidable than any collective that gets riled up and swarms at you like a disturbed hive. I realize that's kind of all over the place, but to a certain extent, because I am still sorting these things, you'll find I'll get lost winding about down the byways. The only consolation is that if you paint yourself into a corner, as I did in the past by rejecting all of the identitarian stuff, there's at least some advantage in that you will have painted every surface of the room. Thereby, you will become familiar with all of it, and painted into a corner, kind of at the end, there's nowhere for you to go. So when I do seem to meander too much, it's because I'm still intellectually kind of painting myself into a corner so that there are certain things that I must see and can then confront. I don't know if this is useful in terms of background.
It just reminds me of my own, not struggles exactly, but dilemmas.
Your own woes.
Well, a few years ago, because I always saw myself as an outsider. I think you do as well. And you don't know how much to romanticize that, how much to just accept it, how much to flaunt it, and how much to suppress it. You know, because these are all moral questions, and they have implications. And, you know, maybe you're, and there's always that concern that I'm just being a wanker. I'm just being a dick. You know, maybe that's all I'm doing here. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Adolescent. But then you don't want to give it up because it's always meant so much to you. And you wonder what kind of creature you would become if you did give up your individuality and your pride in being an eccentric and so on, because that is part of how you conceive of yourself. And so basically you have this dilemma. How should the outsider, how should the eccentric interact with the rest of the village? And because if you're looking at it in microcosm, the villagers are suspicious of him a wee bit. He's a bit suspicious of them. A bit reticent, you know, a bit of mutual suspicion going on. But at the same time, he is part of the furniture of that village. And from his point of view, the villagers are not just part of the furniture of his life, but they are essential for him to conceive of himself as an outsider. And so absolutely, they're very, actually very close to him and very precious to him. But he spends so much time thinking of himself in opposition to them that he doesn't realize that not only are they close to him, but they are part of him and he is part of them. And so this is a complex question. And the thing is, it's not just something that is put on. It's, you know, there are people like you and me who can't escape these dilemmas. This is just the way we are. And it is something that we all, you know, well, especially in these times, have to confront and deal with in some way. And for me, I just saw the enormity of what we were up against as a race. And I thought, okay, that's it. You know, I can't, I've got to do whatever I can to protect my people. And
yeah, I'm not sure. And, about
Sorry, go on. You go.
Not at all. I'm sorry to have cut you off. I think that that's definitely one of the things that affects how I'm approaching all of this is the idea that there is a war going on, and it is actually a war. Now, I'm not trying to, you know, make it all gung-ho and, you know, make this moment like in all the TV shows where someone's supposed to say, go, 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 you know, the great semiotic indicator of the movement of the military in the story where a man shouts, go, 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 right? Which is significant in and of itself, the way in which someone shouts at you, you must move. You know, the idea of the guy standing behind you with a gun so that you fear your officers behind you more than you do the enemy before you. But it is a war, and we are lucky at present that it is a war that takes place in the realm of ideas or the imaginal realm, the realm that is, you know, somehow less concrete than the physical, but for all that more real, since all change in the physical world of men sort of flows downstream. When they say politics is downstream of culture, they really just mean that the affairs of men and events and manifestation are downstream of people's ideas. And so we're lucky enough that right now we can wage that war without it being too violent. Now, that's of little consolation to two Danish women who got raped and decapitated. But it's better than the alternative, as my grandmother used to say about getting old. So that is one aspect. You know, there's a situation where shit's going down. And, you know, there are some things that I can suspend. You know, like saying, like a fascination with first principles. I remain fascinated by them, but I also recognize that the idea that you approach everyone individually has certain limits. You know, so when
this is a crucial point, and it's something that I've brought up several times, is how are you going to stop, like with these Swedish, and I actually did a video, I think I made it private in the end, because for various reasons, but I did a video called "How Would an Individualist Save Swedish Music Festivals?" Because they've got these.
I think I saw that actually,
yeah,
or some reference to.
Yeah, because you know, how can you judge each guy at the door? You know, and it's the same with, like, let's use a broader example: the migrants coming in from the third world into Europe. Are you going to interview each one of them and say, "Now, look, are you going to rape women when once you get into Europe?" Because of course they're going to say no.
Yeah, and that's the point about your old monarch, you know, or a monarch in your sunny isles, your sunny rain-free isles, Elizabeth I, you know, saying in the midst of all the conflict between Catholic and Protestant, the Church of England and crazy ass Anabaptists and, you know, all these other figures in that period of upheaval, religious upheaval, so beautifully summarized by John Donne in Forbidding Morning, satire of religion. Man, you in particular, if you don't know them, you should really have a look at the metaphysical poets. I think they would very much suit your temperament. But what the hell was I just talking about?
About Elizabeth, I think you were going to say that
Elizabeth the First.
Yeah,
exactly.
And that kind of into the minds of men, the souls of men.
No, I do not wish to make windows into the souls of men.
That is it.
You know, yeah. Nor can you, for fuck's sake. And so that led me down a road, you know, sending sort of trollish tweets to Jordan Peterson saying, you know, what can you tell me about the effectiveness of ideological testing? You know, we know that polygraph tests are not admissible really in a court of law. So how the hell are you going to ideologically test these people? And the bottom line is that you cannot. Now, I just did a clip on my channel called Civic versus Ethnic. And in that, I was, you know, trying to wrestle with this a little bit. And I guess to summarize it briefly, there is no ideological test. And an ideological test would be necessary to step around that issue that you just raised, which is how the hell do you just ask them? You know, when I go to the bank and I'd like to walk out with, you know, a groaning wheelbarrow full of gold, you know, and they ask me if I agree to whatever it is I need to get the wheelbarrow full of gold, of course, I'm going to say yes, you know. So how do you test ideologically? And that seems to me that's a big problem with any kind of notion of purely civic nationalism, because the only way that works is if you limit any immigration to a trickle that will allow for the community, number one, to remain a majority, so there's something to acculturate into. But number two, it allows you to live around this new arrival and to see if, in fact, you know, they've sort of put their money where their mouth is. Then you turn around to the idea of ethnic nationalism. And I, for one, I don't believe there's any such thing as purely ethnic nationalism. But when you look at what is typically called ethnic nationalism, the one advantage it has is that you can test for ethnicity and race. You can test.
Yeah.
It's empirical. And so on the one hand, I would, and this is sort of where I'm stuck at present, you know, it would be little consolation to me to live, as I said in my previous clip, among, you know, all whites if I were doing it in Stalinist Russia. You know, oh, it's wonderful. They're all white, but they're all fucking insane, you know? Whereas, you can't, but I should say, but you cannot perform an ideological test. There isn't one, at least with the scale of the immigration that's currently being foisted upon us. And so then you turn around to the idea of ethnic nationalism and an ethnic test. And that has its limits because there are any number of commie bitches and other subversive anti-white creatures who are themselves white and who seem to be, you know, trapped in a moribund suicidal fit of self-annihilation. So whiteness, if you will, in and of itself is no guarantee. However, if we're trapped between civic nationalism that we simply cannot test for and we cannot trust ultimately without a lot of observation that we don't necessarily have time for. And on the other hand, if we have an ethnic nationalism that is by no means certain, but at least shows you a likelihood. And I base this assertion on the idea that we gave rise to the damn culture. It consistently has features that are to some extent or another shared wherever white people live. You know, so there's something that is going to come out of that collective as a manifestation, you know, and it's going to include things like a focus on individual excellence. It's going to have myths about heroes. It's going to have stories where men and women are distinct, but equally due their recognition. You know, it's going to be things that really aren't African, that really aren't East Asian. You know, it's going to be entirely distinct. So in the one instance with civic nationalism, you can't test for it. In the other case with ethnic nationalism, you can test for it. It's no certain guide, but at least it gives you a weight, you know, it's a weighted probability. And so at present, I'm looking at a combination of ethnic and civic nationalism. I think to bring this all the way back around to the issues with precision and definition, which is what I started with. If you think of civic nationalism and ethnic nationalism as mutually exclusive, I think it's like someone telling you you have two choices, at which point any sensible man should put his hand on his wallet and back the fuck up, because there's always more than two. Human beings don't get together simply on the basis of race. You know, if you take a look at Isaac and Ismail.
Yeah, of course, but the issue is that if race is sorted out, if they're off the same race, then that's one massive potential problem that's absolutely simply eliminated. You know, that's the issue. And look what diversity is just so difficult to live with. I mean, all of these complications, all of the provisions that we have to put in place and constantly reinforce and maintain just in order, and I'm talking about liberals, I'm not talking about, I'm talking everyone, just in order to maintain this stasis of diversity is incredibly difficult.
Yes, and so increasingly expensive the more it goes on in every respect, in terms of cultural erosion, in terms of the loss of trust, in terms of violence, you know, the sort of crumbling of all social cohesion. Nevertheless, and I think it's worth calling it out, you know, a lot of people would say, of course, people don't just get together based on the fact that they're white people, you know? And yet, because they don't think about it more carefully, they think that civic and ethnic nationalism are at odds, and they are not. Civic and ethnic nationalism must coexist. If you get a group of white people together and they're all white, great. Okay, now what's our form of government? Which is the point at which civic nationalism enters. And so the first thing I would point out explicitly, though, again, you know, the smarter people have already thought of this and it's already occurred to them, but the precision is important. I'm a civic and an ethnic nationalist. as, you know, such terms go. Now, for my part, because I'm in America, which is a slightly different animal, I am more inclined to look to a solution that goes with the maintenance of a cultural supermajority, which is just a friendly way of saying minimum 67%, sweet spot 75% white people. And you do whatever you need to do in terms of encouraging reproduction and limiting migration and all the rest in order to ensure that there's roughly 75% whites, at which point there is a culture into which others, into which those who are exceptional, for whom exceptions must be made, into which they can be accommodated. But the rest of this, like, just destroy it all, you know, is it's unacceptable. You know, the cultural balkanization, you know, with the East India Company, both the Dutch and the English, and, you know, world travel and trade and the exposure of Western Europeans. We'd long been around Jews who had their own methods of sharing funds and all the rest. But when we traveled the world, we interacted with Parsis who had the same sort of techniques, you know, and allied with the Zoroastrians in India. Now Mumbai is today one of the richest places, you know, in India, paying most of the taxes. We ran into Armenians when the British East India Company started to trade with Iran, and we learned that the Armenians were originally bankers of the King of Kings, holding their gold up in the mountains. And then you find out, wow, the Parsis, the Jews, the Armenians, these are parallel structures that allow for parallel economic structures that allow for the exertion of power over military and political entities that you otherwise couldn't affect because you didn't have a standing army. And yet, you know, by allying with different groups in India, we could bring down the Mughals, you know, and the rest. So we have been exposed to all of this, to the entrepot. We've cut our teeth, the great traders, and I mean with a D, not a T, but there are all sorts of opportunities there, you know, between trader and trader. But but the great traders of the world have seen what happens when you create a cosmopolitan, multi-ethnic city, as they did in Singapore, as they did in, you know, Cape Town, as they've done all over the place. And so they see the value in that balkanization, and it has been applied. And, you know, I am not one of the people who assigns that just to one renegade ethnic group. However, I think that the lesson that can be learned from how all of these ethnic groups always push to the margins, you know, how they can manipulate things through their knowledge of balkanization and the introduction of cosmopolitan multiculturalism, it's something we should all be aware of. I feel like I just wandered off somewhere else.
Yeah, I can't even remember what the question, what I asked you in the first place.
But I did my job well, yeah.
Well, yeah, it's, I mean, I guess that there are so many things that you said that I could comment on. But, I mean, it's ultimately what you're saying is that any society, even one that's ethnically homogenous or supermajority, still needs a culture in order to bind it together, because otherwise you'll get cultural disagreement, cultural
and specifically, well, that's a nice way to summarize. You actually rescued me and made what I was meandering about doing seem more like it was connected. I thank you. Because there is the cultural aspect, and that is part of what raises issues in the United States that you would not, for example, face in a place like, or as much in a place like Scotland, I would think, right? Because there are any number of legitimate white cultures in the United States that have to coexist, and there are differences between all of them. You know, Catholic and Protestant is a major one, you know. Whereas you don't have that with Scotland as much. I mean, you have the vestiges of the religious conflict, certainly, but there's not as much to accommodate in terms of differences. So that's one side is cultural, but the other one that I want to call out explicitly is the ideological basis for the political covenant, which I think is what I was getting at with the civic nationalism. You know, the big thing that concerns me about the false dichotomy proposed here with the difference between civic and ethnic nationalism is it kind of gets everyone to say, all we need to focus on is the fact that we should all be white and agree. And what that does is it tables the question for later regarding under what political covenant. And I think that that's not by accident. I think in many cases, you know, the people who would prefer to sing the Horst Wessel lied, you know, those folks are perfectly happy to table the questions about the form of government for later.
Yeah. I think an interesting point is that people can fall into nihilism in multiple ways. And one of them is, I would say that they're definitely going in this direction. You could see the beginnings of it with the alt-right among certain quarters. You've got the ethnic thing down. Okay, we believe and we care about our race. We care about that ethnic identity and so on. And that's the end of the matter. But then that's a form of nihilism because it's completely material. You know, there's nothing transcendent. And now some people will say that the race is transcendent. It is a thing that stretches off into the past and the future. Yeah, sure. But again, there's in what way does the individual interact with that continuum? Because otherwise, if you're not going to define that, then and that would be something that was defined culturally, then basically you've still got a guy atomized in the here and now, who's just got this sort of phantom thing reassuring him, you know, about the race. And, you know, don't worry, it will outlast you and all that, but just sit on the couch and eat crisps, you know, for now. You know, it's still a form of nihilism. I know that people will sort of dislike me for saying that. I'll look at the live chat, there might be people reprimanding me for saying that, but it's true. I mean, you do get people who do think... Well, they seem to place too much emphasis on the race thing, because to the exclusion of other things, to the exclusion of culture and religion. And I say this as someone who's not religious; I'm agnostic, reluctantly. Waiting for persuasion, I would say. The point is that just to place everything, you're sort of to bank everything on racial identity, I think is naive, and it will ultimately lead you to, it just seems something that's not enough on its own. It is a component, it probably is a crucial component, but it's not enough on it. On its own, it will die. On its own, it will, I think it will lead to destruction.
And culturally, we have a number of, institutions in place, formal and informal, that sort of take some of the tension out of that relationship between collective and individual. You know, you talked about how, you know, the collective and the individual are sort of eyeing each other, and the collective is, you know, sort of necessary to the individual and defining him or herself to some extent. If you posit an individual super consciousness, then it's less so. But what I want to add to that is that the collective often throws rocks and individuals until they stop moving. You know, the monkeys will shit in their hands and throw it at you when they're afraid. You can look at all the classic themes, like in Seven Samurai, they go ask the old man what to do about the threat to their village. And he lives in a mill outside of town because they prefer that you live outside of town, just like shamans and the rest. If you come into town too often, they might throw rocks at you until you start moving. And, you know, so I'd ask you to consider, vis-a-vis the individual and the collective, whether or not the repugnant attack on you conducted by the press, that if I understand it correctly, you know, to a certain extent drove you out of your home, the utterly repulsive actions, these things, you know, I wonder if there might be some value for you in meditating upon to what extent that has to do with the dynamic regarding the individual and the collective, as distinct from what ideas you happened to have been discussing that offended them. You see, it's, you can talk about how they're important in defining your identity, but I think that, anyway, let's not go off into that. I think you've got enough, and you're honest enough with yourself that you'll go and look at these events and, you know, consider them. I think actually that's worth noting. You're channel, you yourself seem very, very honest which is why I'm so interested in talking to you, because you can actually get somewhere. But the point is that with the collective versus the individual, we have to come up with some way of dealing with that tension that exists there. Those who see themselves as being a part of the collective, well, the individual is just somebody who doesn't belong. It's not really a consideration. But I think the tension, the dynamic between the individual and the collective in our culture is fundamental to its growth and its strength. And so that's why I think the civic as well as the ethnic must be dealt with in order to arrive at anything worthwhile.
Yeah, just let me read out this super chat, which I think is relevant. Someone, Waterpenny, said, cultural supremacy is vital, but the social contract is crucial. I don't know what
you'd have to have both. And my big concern is with, you know, whenever people start to advocate collectivization and they don't distinguish it from cooperation, then there are all kinds of issues. Now, I will say, though, that Jason over at No White Guilt said something that just kind of made me have to go wander off and chew on it for a bit, because he wasn't speaking directly to me, but in one of his discussions, he was like, you know, if individualism is so central to Western culture and Hawaiians and all the rest, then why do we have to worry about it disappearing? It would apparently be so integral to our nature that, you know, we could try the best we could to push it down and it would still pop back up. You know, to a certain extent, for me, that was like throwing down the gauntlet. I was like, well, I guess he has a point, you know.
Like, I'm just thinking that. I mean, the USSR only lasted, what, 60 years?
Well, China's still around, and it's part of the same sort of experiment. They just moved it to a larger population block and gave it, you know, some Chinese characteristics. So the entire...
Exactly, but it's a different... But it's a different people, isn't it?
The communist movement is always global. Yes, it's a different people. And they probably, I get your point, made that decision about, you know, moving it over here as an alternative for good reason, because people tended to barf it back up. You know, it wouldn't stay down when they tried to swallow the pill. But for some few, they always will.
I was wrong, it's 70 years, of course. For some reason, I got 1920 to 1990 and thought that was 60 years. It was 70 years. Yes, I think it was 1919 or 1918 when it was established, and 1991 was it when it ended? Can't recall. But anyway, so I would say that might be evidence that individualism does, it just will resurge in the white spirit. But I don't know. I mean, I'm not being smug or complacent about that. It's just one. It was just what occurred to me when you said that.
Yeah, and it might. And it occurred to me, you know, when I was listening to Jason say it, I was like, you know what? Okay, put your money where your mouth is. If you think that that's really the central aspect, then yeah, it will survive. It will spontaneously manifest. Now, to be fair, to balance it against that, you know, I think that there is a great deal that got worked out in English common law, which, you know, the more I learn about it, the more impressed I am with it.
A lot of people have said that to me, actually, that the English common law is, as you say, so much was already grappled with and sort of resolved to whatever extent that can happen with English common law.
And that's why I'm concerned about the people who just say, let's focus on all the white people getting together and not worry about the form of government, because, you know, there are all sorts of harebrained innovators. And I think that, you know, as we say down south, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, and in this case, I reckon it ain't broke in a lot of respects. You know, the civic aspect of the contract is there are certain things that have been laid down, you know, tested by time of enormous value that we should be very careful about dispensing with. And, you know, being an American, I believe that the U.S. Constitution, Bill of Rights are among those things, you know, and I would certainly say that, you know, the Great Charter in Britain and the English common law traditions are certainly a part of that shared heritage as well. So I'm suspicious of those who assert a need for socialism, but that's probably a much larger subject that we wouldn't have time to get into. One thing I will say is, you know, just to pitch an idea and to do it in public so your audience has an opportunity to respond to it. I think that the importance of the alt-right or dissident right as a cultural movement is really where my interest lies. I think that there are a lot of details that have to be sorted out before it can properly be a political movement, like precision with definitions and recognizing explicitly this issue between, you know, civic and ethnic nationalism. I think the idea of defining white is a big deal too. You hear people like Sargon talk about it, and I get why people are like, oh, fuck you. You just look at somebody, they're fucking white. You can see it. Fine. However, if we're talking about something that becomes a law, then there must be a test, and a test has criteria. And so that's why I say I don't think the dissident right is ready to be playing in politics yet. You know, there are people like, I think Greg Johnson thinks pretty carefully, you know, Jared Taylor thinks carefully, systematically. I even like Alt-Hype. You know, even though he kind of has that technical school kind of annoying that always gets me. You know, the guys who are really into math and engineering and their impatience with anybody who's interested in the humanities. So there, yeah, I don't mean
INTJ supremacy.
Yeah. And so I think that there are people who are doing what needs to be done to make it political. But my interest is in the cultural dimension. And so when I say I'm ready to cooperate, I am. And I think I have useful things to say about the cultural dimension. And what I pitched to you is I'd love to have a discussion sometime about the house as technology. Home is merely an abstract noun that derives from the house, which is a physical location and a piece of technology. It's shelter. But it also serves to block out some things that we should not give attention to, except through windows, and we have blinds that we can close. It has rooms that get divided up to make arrangements for certain human activities. You know, what we now call the living room in the United States is a room where you sit in a chair and look at a television and enjoy anything but life, right? So there's much that can be unpuzzled by looking at the house as the physical basis for the reified abstraction we call home. And then as soon as you start looking at a house, you start to look at intergenerational dialogue. You start to look at things like whether a house is passed on through generations and what wisdom can be contained in it. What social relationships can be established based on the layout of the house, because they shape how you must interact. There are certain paths you have to walk, rooms for certain things, and that can shape the articulation of a family across time and generations. And I think that would be a subject that would be very interesting to the females who are looking at having a cultural impact. And I think there are any number of things that could spin off of that. I've been looking particularly at the idea of foster fathers and foster traditions for fostering a child, particularly in the Caucasus with the Circassians, where they call it süt beslemesi. It's a Turkish word, but the Circassians use it. It's the idea of milk brotherhood and the way in which children would be sent to be raised by those close to the family in order to move them away from the parents, perhaps too close care, which is understandable, and to ensure that they learn other things that the parent might not be able to teach them. And at the same time, you form bonds between these aforementioned houses. And then over time, you have networks of these houses and the relationships between them. Essentially, the reason I'm looking at the house this way, and I'd love to talk to you about it sometime, is because I think it is the central institution that has been destroyed. Take a look at multifamily dwellings. You know, take a look at the way that you're shipped around to go live somewhere new and you never establish roots. You never get a sense that this is my land and I'll die on it. You know, I saw some of your excellent discussions. One of them was with Boer Republic. I really enjoyed. And you get a sense that those people, whether they'll say it explicitly or not, kind of have this sense of no, no, my ancestors bled to establish us here. And that's been taken from us because we get stuck into multifamily units. Because we've lost the idea of the house as a technology. Just look at what happens when you're raised by parents who do a thing, like flamencos in Spain, who raise their children to dance and start them at age 6. You know, certain skills can be transmitted through the family. And because you start so early when a child is pliable, they can achieve degrees of excellence with it that are otherwise unavailable. And then think about something like building an alliance with another house by sending the child off to be fostered with another group. And think about how that's been replaced by public school, by boarding school, by college, where they're sent off for their collectivist indoctrination. So I bring that up because I think it would be a very interesting discussion. It would be a way to look at these cultural dimensions, to anchor them in a physical thing so they're not too often, you know, gaseous invertebrate abstract land, right? And I think that would be an example of how it is that I propose to be helpful, how it is I propose to cooperate. And that is by seeing things perhaps other people don't notice, and reintroducing them to the discussion for those who say they wish to achieve these things, like, for example, preventing the utter destruction of the West.
What right. well, we'll have to wrap up now because the next guest is waiting. But briefly, I just want to get your thoughts on this thing. Someone said in the chat, the 2020s are going to be chaos. What do you think about that? It's a complete change of topic, but I think it'd be an interesting one to end on.
Well, I've been going back and forth on that with Mr. Tim for quite some time. We have been, and he has been, inaccurate in many respects with our predictions in terms of when chaos will erupt. But I think there is no way around the eruption of a certain amount of chaos. And I think that that holds true for the United States. It holds true for Canada, for Australia, you know, New Zealand, Europe in general. We might not have to wait till the 2020s, but we'll see. I think what is most likely is that everything will get kicked off as soon as someone actually makes some concrete effort to actually remove opportunistic migrants who have no business being in the countries that they're in, at which point the ghost-to-ghost network will fire up and they'll use all those wonderful iPads and cell phones that have been given to them to communicate with each other transnationally across all these areas that they have moved into, and they will begin to respond. And they will do so, I believe, through acting out, which means beating up trash cans, smashing windows, setting fire to things. As Tim has pointed out, much of all of the bad behavior from these people has been on hold because they've been waiting to get apartments because they need a place to organize their operations, you know, where they're not in a migrant center being viewed all the time. But as they've now gotten housing from the state, they have places, for example, to bring back things that they've stolen and arrange to ship them elsewhere or to sell them. You know, they have places now to have meetings and all the rest. They have their no-go areas. So to answer the question, and I could go on forever, but I'm sensitive. I don't want to, you know, push your other scheduling off. I think it's going to happen. It's going to happen sooner than later. It will have many different faces. You know, this yellow vest stuff, I think we just have to wait to see who gets to own the revolution, because I think right now the yellow vests are contested. Both the left and the right are trying to own that movement, and they're dumping money into it in order to do so. So that the outcome of that is in question, but I think it's really going to kick off when someone actually just decides to really round up some of the migrants, at which point, chaos is indicated.
Okay. All right. That's great. And there are loads of things that we could talk about in the future, and I hope we do. So I don't want to make any promises, but I do intend to use my live channel more next year than I have hitherto. So it might be nice to have some collaborations. But of course, I don't want to dilute this sort of specialness of Millennial by doing it throughout the year. So
right. Well,
we'll see. We'll see.
I do want to take the opportunity to thank you, and I appreciate this. I've been watching the clips that you put up, and there are several of them that were just great. I really, really enjoyed them, and there were people that I would not have been exposed to without you putting this together. So thank you for having me, and thank you for doing this. No good deed goes unpunished.
Well, quite a lot of people in the live chat have been saying that they like you, they find you very interesting and likable and so on. So I hope this will, you know, benefit your channel as well.
I appreciate that. I hope it does.
Okay. Excellent. Let's leave it at that. So that's Oliver from SemioGog. Thank you for taking part in Millennial 2018. I was you were one of my priorities to get on this year, so thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And I'll be back hopefully soon with the Bronx Blogger, which I imagine will be an interesting but quite different conversation. So I will see you then. Bye-bye for now.